You're listening to Triple Radio on the Fat Gatsby Network.
Okay. And I've been given the go-ahead to start recording from Tim.
All right. Recording is commenced. Everybody, oh, is my audio going out? I don't even know.
It did go out just for a sec, but then now you're back. Now I hear.
Well, now I'm looking at OBS, and it doesn't look like I'm going out, which is weird. Why would I not be going out from OBS? What is this?
I don't know.
Or at least I'm not seeing levels.
I am seeing levels in my DAW from across the internet, so I can vouch that.
Am I hearing myself through Twitch? I am not hearing myself through Twitch. Okay.
Good gravy. Well, while Tim is going to sort out his audio. We are
okay.
In fact recording.
There we go.
Fine.
All right, we're good.
You are an audible person with a voice.
Yeah, I'm good. I think.
All right.
I'm good, I think. Yep. Okay. All right. Yeah, I'll still blame it on Discord messing with my audio settings. Hey, this is Tim. That's Dave. That's Weiss.
Hello. Tim, you've honestly never sounded better.
It's okay. Pretty good.
Great. Sure.
Whatever got fucked up. Do it every time. Cause wow. Just golden. The golden throat on this golden boy here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They call me on the streets.
That's
the golden throat.
Look out, everybody. Hey, guys. Hey. What are we talking about? What are we talking about today?
We got a big midsummer Triple Radio special that I did not promote in advance at all.
Hmm.
It's been a busy month over here.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of goings on. I kind of just really snuck up on me. We are doing, much like last year, we did our top 10 games of all time. This year, we're doing a little midsummer special, a little break from the norm. We are counting down our top 10 movies since the year 2000, since and including, I also included 2000. I mean,
yes.
I think something is in there that made that relevant. Maybe not.
Movies of the millennium. Yeah, I actually don't know if I do. I think all of mine are, I think my earliest is 2001, I think.
Oh, okay. Yeah, and IndieWire did a very large article a year or two ago of the movies of the basically exactly what we're doing. Which is very handy to reference.
Yeah, I remember there being a lot of chatter, I want to say, last year in 2025, as there was you know, the first quarter of this century has passed, a century that we will not see the end of. We will be dead by then.
Speak for yourself.
God willing. We'll be out of here by the year 2100.
I'm drinking children's blood. I'm doing all the billionaire things.
That's why you had two kids.
Yep. Yeah.
Yep.
That's why. Yeah. That's why.
On the other side of this wall is the station where Dave's children are drained of their blood.
That's right. I got two of them. One heir, one spare, baby.
Yeah.
And I take it back. I do have a movie from the year 2000. So,
okay. All right. Yeah.
Sneaking in there.
But
this was tough.
I'm not going to talk about ones that just barely didn't make the list, just in case they made one of y'all's lists.
Yeah. I guess that's probably a good idea.
I guess we're going to. Yeah. I don't want to blow the load here right up front. Just being like, this barely made a list. And then I'm just like named like half of Weiss's. We'll do the thing where if somebody has a movie higher on their list than someone else, we will wait to discuss it until it reaches that highest point.
Yep.
Yeah, that's been working.
So, yeah, we won't. It's not like, here's my number two movie, and we talked about it like an hour ago because someone else liked it less than me. I think much more so than games, someone's going to have movies that I'm going to be like, oh, shit. Forgot about.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be like, that probably should have been on my list. Though I did, you know, go through some best of lists of the various years and kind of. But the thing is also, some of my movies do not appear on the top of a best of list and perhaps weren't so critically well received at the time. And
I'm sure we all have those.
Yes. Yeah. Only got their flowers maybe at least a decade later after people actually watched the movie and reevaluated it.
Yeah.
Are we just going to Okay.
On the flip side of that, I've got more than a few that are kind of the inverse of that, where they are movies that I loved at the time, but either after revisiting them, found that they don't hold up, or they were directed by people who I've kind of lost respect for.
There was a clear one of those ones that unfortunately had to go.
Oh, is that Booty Tang?
That's one of them.
No, that had unfortunately gone by the last time we had done one of these lists. That wasn't directed by, that was written by. But
No. All right. Anyways.
There's a lot of
we'll clean up the mess at the end.
Yes.
We'll clean up the mess at the end. But let's dig into it. Let's start at number 10.
Okay. And numbers are kind of, I mean, they're there, but they are kind of arbitrary at this point with how good
I definitely did some work on this list like a week and a half ago and then came back to it today and was like, okay, I guess I have to go with it now.
Yeah, a lot of frantic reshuffling at the last minute for me.
Yeah, I feel good about the top five. and I feel good about...
I feel good about my top three, but beyond that, I'm like, I'm killing a lot of darlings.
The
order of
the top three is very debatable. All right, number 10, though.
All right. Tim, why don't you start us off?
I'll start it off. Okay. Number 10 for me is The Raid: Redemption.
Did not make mine on that one.
Yeah, basically the bar that I judge like every martial arts action movie against for this century. And I think that feels to me like the standout, like in general, in what everything since then has kind of been compared to, in a lot of ways. It just, The Raid's awesome. You know, it's just very straightforward, go into building and fight floors and floors of bad guys with really great choreography. Which, you know, made a name for a lot of the people that were in the movie and made the movie, and they went on to make a bunch more movies. And every time I'm just kind of like, well, this was like The Raid in this way or better than The Raid in that way, or, you know, it's just, that's what I compare things to.
It was like the last one that really caught like in a mainstream like sense at this point too. Like, caught the zeitgeist, like, is still compared to, people still talk about this fight or that fight. I just finally saw The Furious, which was great, and you know, of course, seeing Guy from The Raid show up, and you're like, and you don't have to say anything, you're like, oh, Guy from The Raid, and he has a bow and arrow, so everybody's fucked.
I knew this movie was going to be on someone's list. I've never seen it still, and just over the years, the number of times not only that you guys have referenced it, but the number of times increasingly I'm seeing how much it has influenced action cinema since, and how there's been sort of this like diaspora of talent that was associated with that one film that spread out to the wider industry. It was one that I really wished that I had in like the 2 weeks since we firm decided we were going to do this. It was one that I really wished I found time to actually watch for the first time.
Well, it's always a good time to see The Raid for the first time.
Yeah, baby.
Dave, what's your number 10?
My number 10 is Christopher Nolan's Inception. Anyone else want to talk about it?
Nope.
Oh no.
All right.
No, if I was going to do Nolan, it would be the one that we reference in our end of the year. Like that was on my short list, but it did not make it.
So I rewatched both of these fairly recently with my teenager, and between the like they are both awesome, and this was kind of a toss up, and honestly it barely scraped by making it in my top 10, but I do think it is just my favorite like high concept, not exactly sci-fi, and that's kind of what's great about it, is that it's sort of sci-fi but not exactly sci-fi. It's just a crazy high concept thriller, and in terms of like the cast and I think the clarity of the story, I think arguably The Prestige, you could say it's a bit more focused in terms of being the story of one man's obsession, but there's something about Inception in particular that I find not only a little more poignant, but also just a little more just kick-ass to watch. There's so many more moments, I think, in Inception where I'm like, this is really fun. This is crazy shit, but this is really fun. And that's why it wins for me.
I haven't seen it since the theater.
Damn.
Same, I think.
I'm pretty sure I own it, but yeah, I haven't. It's a long watch, but yeah, I have not. This did, I mean, you know, think about this did make me just want to be like, I want to watch a bunch of movies. I never get to watch movies.
Yeah.
I just never get to.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
This was tough.
And I was, I was going to say, like, not only want to watch movies, I didn't get to rewatch stuff, and a lot of the list, like, would be wildly different if I got to rewatch a lot of these things. Like,
probably.
Memories
is very vibes based.
Yeah, it's vibes based and going like, okay, how do I think I feel about it now? I haven't watched this in, you know, however many years.
Yeah, yeah.
This transitioned over to me, or
go ahead. Tee it up.
All right. This one I'm doing Paddington 2. We're going.
Hell yeah!
Yeah, we're hitting.
It was on my long list.
Yeah, it's coming up for a rewatch with the girlfriend, and I can't wait. It is about to blow the roof off. we just rewatched Pee Wee's Big Holiday, and going from like it's the. You know, the difference between like the movie that has like the protagonist character arc versus the character changes the world around them, and Paddington taking that beautiful, what I think of as the Pee-wee formula. And, you know, we take this lovely bear, we lock him into prison, and then he has a lot to say about the industrial prison complex. I was rewatching the trailer and just like the gorgeous shot of like grandma on the boat on the pop-up book, and like just the way that like Paul King, especially like off of Mighty Boosh, going to make made the Bunny and the Bull in between, but like just taking that visual sense into kids cinema. And just like knocking it out of the, like, it doesn't have to go this hard. Like that movie would have done, would have been beloved if that script had fallen to a less capable hands. But it like made it there. It's just like everything fires, and it's just a delight.
I think as we throughout this list, I am definitely going to have a lot more all ages films to discuss. And I think a big theme that occurred to me in going back over this is that the films that endure really feel like they're the ones that are way more earnest as opposed to the ones that are subversive. Like the ones that try to make fun of the thing are the ones that get the easy laugh, but the ones that really believe in the material and follow it earnestly are the ones that have endured. So,
well, that's very true for my top three.
Right.
It's a statement. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, certainly. Yeah.
Yeah, that does, and the top four even, you know,
like when that IndieWire list came out, like I did like a rough version, and even, you know, a year ago I was looking at the difference, and like I think it's more, this one is more just like optimistic. Maybe it's just like it feels too dark right now too, I don't know. I'm curious like how everybody's lists kind of like feel all together at this point.
Yeah, no, it's definitely vibes based, I had to settle on the bulk of my list being the movies that like this movie's a good go to. Like, yeah, there's a lot of very dark and intense films that I have loved over the past 27 years, but the ones that have stuck with me are the ones that I can put on at any time and have a good time.
Replayability is a big factor. Yeah. Well,
yeah, number nine. Dave, why don't we start with you?
Number nine. My number nine is the David Wayne film Wet Hot American Summer.
Yeah, that is slightly higher on mine.
Okay.
Right. You have that one in there.
We will wait.
Yep. Well, then we will wait. Yep. Then we should do number nine.
I have Yeah, I went back and forth on this, and it is only because I have seen it so many times that it is ingrained in my memory versus like a couple movies that I need to rewatch. Mm. But putting Hot Fuzz in,
Hot Fuzz. 9,
also on the long list.
Yeah, I went back and forth because it.
Man, I gotta watch that movie again.
Yeah, it's been a while. As big as Edgar Wright was for us, I do think like it's, you know, he isn't like the end all be all anymore, right? So like I always kind of forget how good, like especially like Cornetto trilogy spaced, like you know, a lot of like the, well, he's been around a long time, so I guess yeah. Early stuff has kind of been, and Hot Fuzz is just like what a like comfort watch, what a like climax of just everything coming together. I don't think I laugh harder than like all the slasher jokes with James Bond. you know, the Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet. There's so many like little touches. It's kind of like the best use of his like fast cutting visual storytelling, great soundtrack. And it's just, yeah, it's the easiest one to throw on. Like, I think I like The World's End more than a lot of people. And that one's kind of like the cool one to throw on, I feel, at this point, because I don't remember every beat. And, like, it's weird. And there's stuff that's, you know, that's a little shaggy. But, like, Hot Fuzz is just, like, a real tight version of, like, everything Edgar Wright was, like, going for.
It's always been my favorite of the Cornetto trilogy, yeah, and it's the one that I have been most eager to convince my kids to give a shot. Like, if the so many of these movies, I have spent the past 2 weeks begging my kids to sit down and be like, hey, who wants to watch an old movie with dad? You guys are going to love this. And they just no, they just would not. But Hot Fuzz is one that I have long just been dying to.
Yeah, I think this might be an easy sell for Richard because I can just lean into the whodunitness of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
And yeah, I think that'll happen pretty soon now that I think about it. All right.
Yep.
Number 9 for me is Casino Royale.
Oh,
yeah, yep, shortlist.
My favorite Bond movie, which also I've been thinking about lately, because I did, we'll get to it, I don't know, some other time, that I played First Light in the last
one. Oh, sure.
So Bond is heavy on the mind, but still, for, you know, having seen almost every Bond movie, there's still like two in the chamber that I've just kind of like never watched. I've done that with Godzilla movies too. I just got a couple I've never watched, just so there's some new ones in there someday.
Yeah, yep.
When I feel like it. But yeah, I mean, I still think hands down Casino Royale, just like that opening, like the title song, the whole vibe of the new era with Daniel Craig was so good. And you know, great action scenes and great, you know, kind of classic Bond drama to it. It's awesome. It's still
best
like my
Bond theme.
I think so. Yeah. Why?
Just curious. Just I think it's my favorite too.
Oh yeah.
It's very high up there. Yeah, I still prefer the Shirley Bassey, you know, like the classic stuff. But man,
sure.
It is fucking.
It is.
It's like, a banger.
Chris Cornell ain't nothing to fuck with.
No, it's, you know, it, nothing else top three.
It really
suits the, you know, what they were doing with the movie and the character, and just it's rare that like the like all those things intersect correctly for a Bond movie theme, really. So yeah, I mean, I think it's the best one.
Movie rules.
Yeah, it's awesome. Yeah, moving on to number, and then that guy went and made the Green Lantern movie.
Wild director.
Like, just absolutely obliterated this James Bond movie. And then, like, I don't think he's done some okay thing. I think he also did Bumblebee, I want to say, which was good.
Really? I think he did.
Yeah.
I think you're right.
He's been just really all over the place.
And even, you know, much to say between Casino Royale and Quantum of Solace, though people keep saying if you do them back to back, it makes Quantum feel better. I just don't have it in me.
Quantum is the weakest of the Daniel Craig ones by a fair margin. Like it's a totally serviceable James Bond movie with some
terrible editing.
Okay parts, but yeah. Mostly just
Yeah.
I think Skyfall is obviously very good. I think Spectre is better than people say it is. And then there's the last one, which is also fine. No Time to Die. That's what it's called. All right. Number eight, Weiss. Right.
Yes. Some of these kind of have to like reflect a little of the zeitgeisty and like could not put Fury Road on here.
I got that a little bit higher.
All right. All right, we'll talk about it in a bit then.
Yeah.
Let's just talk about it now. I'll just switch them. Who cares?
There you go.
What am I doing? It's like literally I had it next on my list, but like let's just do this now.
Yeah. And I was about to switch this one too, so whatever. Yeah. Yep, exactly. Yeah, it's fucking what movie starts with more of a rocket out of the gate?
Turn off the rocket and just keeps rocketing across the desert.
It's emblematic of like the older director coming back and just showing everyone how to do it, which has happened a few times now since this came out in 2015. But like George Miller is still a madman in the best possible way.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I feel like, there's just so much that came out of that movie, the amount of times I just yell like witness when I'm about to do something stupid in a video game or otherwise. Sometimes I just see a server at work that's labeled witness and I just say witness.
It changed, we don't get many that change language or like throw out ideas. And also like all, very progressive, like feminist storytelling and like all the stuff under the hard to not say under the hood, but under the hoods. Like it works on like every level, and you can go in completely brain dead and you can go in and
I was brain dead. This was when my child was like a week old. No brains in my head.
I mean, they shouldn't have let me drive when I got out of that theater.
They shouldn't let anybody drive. Everyone should have to stay put.
Yep.
This one went back and forth making it into my top 10, and ultimately it got relegated to a bit higher up in the teens, and that's only because I have not revisited it since the theater. But for so many years after seeing that initial watch in the theater, I just felt like I had to spread the gospel of it. Like, no, this is one of the greatest films ever made. Intellectually, I am aware that I am aware of feeling like it is one of the greatest films I've ever seen in my life. But it's been so long that I could not articulate to you why, which is really the only reason I had to leave it off my top 10.
I haven't gotten back to it either, but it just never left me. It's just something that I think about, which is a strong sign of a strong movie when
and we're doing a podcast. Part of this is like the stuff that got left off is like I know that like I felt so strongly about blank or blank, but I don't have much to say about it because I haven't watched it in 10 years or so.
Yeah, so that's what's tough about doing this. So many all the films that I felt deserve it, but I would not be able to speak intelligibly to the point. So,
Dave, you're number eight.
My number eight.
Blaze through this one.
The debut feature from Jared and Jerusha Hess, Napoleon Dynamite. And this is largely based on a very recent rewatch, so this might be some recency bias. Some weesency bias.
My new podcast.
If there is any, if I could cite any example of an indie film that is just sort of centered around, I mean, Weiss, I guess it's sort of in the Paddington Pee-wee vein, where it's just the film is really just central to one character, and and he does not change, but he does affect the world around him. And after watching it with my kids, and just really all of us sort of agreeing, like, yeah, this hits. Yeah, I totally get why we were all endlessly quoting this movie, because John Heder's embodiment of this very singular film character is so special and so unique. And then I had to have a conversation with my aspiring actress daughter about, like, you know, what would you prefer? Would you prefer to have a long and successful career in, like, featured roles, or would you rather have one big hit that is what you're associated with, but it's a character that everyone will always remember, and like, it will never die. I feel like the overexposure to Napoleon Dynamite within its first decade of release made it get tiresome, but honestly, rewatching it, the earnestness with which this world is created, and the slice of life of, you know, living in rural Ohio or Idaho, I'm sorry, is still a pretty singular cinematic experience. And the relatability of, we've all known a kid like this. The reasons why Napoleon Dynamite are good are actually really, really great. And in 2 decades of hindsight, you know, giving it a chance to sort of let it rest, it still holds up amazingly well. So, yeah, it's on my list.
Oh, yeah.
A thing to be ashamed of. All right, number 7, and we're on me. This was...
Yeah,
very tough, because I really only wanted to put one other animated movie on this list other than the very obvious one that we'll get to. And I, this might also be some recency bias. I chose Spirited Away.
I took Spirited Away off only because I haven't gone back to it in so long.
Yeah, this was, you know, I won't mention the other two yet, just in case they pop up.
Sure.
But Of those, this was one that was watched a lot when Richard was growing up. And, you know, we rewatched we watched a ton of Ghibli movies. Like, Ghibli was his Disney growing up. He's maybe seen a lot of those Disney animated classics like once, but like, the Ghibli movies were on constantly, and I hadn't really seen Spirited Away. I hadn't seen most of those movies really until I was watching them with Richard, just like, started watching Princess Mononoke when he's like 4, and like, somebody gets their arm shot off right at the beginning. It's like, ooh, we were talking earlier today about his first rated R movie, which was about alligators in a basement when he was like 5 years old, called Crawl. We watched that when he was like 5.
Funny.
Yeah, I showed him Predator when he was like 7. Anyway, Spirited Away, what a movie. Of course, beautiful animation, but just, I love the journey of it and the weirdness of it through this bathhouse, and it's just, everything is so imaginative, and I don't know, it's just, always watched it like, just like, a ton, and just love them, just, you know, the kid losing themselves from the parents and having to find their way back, in the end. And there's so many kind of memorable characters and situations and stuff in that movie. And, you know, I mean, all the Ghibli movies are classics in their own way, but, Spirited Away.
Nice.
Dave.
Okay. My number 7 is, the earliest film on my list from the year 2000. It's Disney's The Emperor's New Groove.
And that was on my short list.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good pick.
Yeah.
I like that.
It is just got the best of Disney's and like classic Looney Tunes sensibilities joined together. A miracle that it turned out good due to its long, protracted and troubled development, in which it changed styles and themes and plot like many, many times over. The fact that it wound up to be this like timeless, and this really is kind of the epitome of, if you put this movie on in front of me, I can sit down and start having a good time. I can jump in at any point, sit down and start having a good time, because every moment, there's so many just moments in this movie that are pure comedy gold, pure like visual comedy gold. Fantastic performances from all the leads. You know, I've the now classic quotable lines, Cusco's poison, the poison chosen especially for Cusco. And
pull the lever. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And God, just wonderful. The moments that don't pander to children, but they're also not necessarily like, here's a little wink for the adults. It's just a funny bit of character stuff. Kronk is going out to get his cheese puffs or whatever from the kitchen, and it's just Cusco and Yzma at the table, and he's like, so he seems nice. And she says, yes, yes, he is. And he says, so what is he like in his late 20s? She's like, I'm not sure. Just like a little, and that's it. That's the end of the joke. Him implying that they're sleeping together and that he is way too young for her. And like, and that's all that need be said. At, just smart, quippy dialogue. God, I love this movie.
If you haven't seen, I can't not every time recommend a documentary that is, you have to seek out the Sweatbox.
Yeah.
Sting's wife or part, Trudy Styler just had unabashed access to this thing.
Yeah,
and it's crazy.
It is
good
it
choice. Is good choice.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, I mean, there's. Just they don't make them. They didn't make them really like that at the time.
No,
they don't make them like that since then either. They did not make them before or since. They just like Disney, especially. It's just like, no, it's a musical, or it's like, you know, they do the 3D animated stuff, which are now all musicals as well. It's, you know, it's all 3D animated now. Not that they're not wonderful in their own right, but
But no, you know, it's a road really, movie. It's a buddy comedy.
It's it's fantastic.
Yeah.
It really stands out.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Weiss.
Yeah. So I keep shuffling things around, but needed a Guillermo del Toro spot. Mm-hmm. And like,
ooh.
I know. Like, if I,
he's had a pretty good couple of decades.
Sure has. This was, I mean, like, I took Miyazaki off of here, so I'm glad that you like, you know, like, memory plays with a lot of this, because like, it's probably Pan's Labyrinth, but I'm putting down Guillermo's Pinocchio.
Wow,
that's. It's in that, Pinocchio, Pan's Labyrinth, the Devil's Backbone are, like, he's said, like, those are, like, those are a trilogy, and, like, that is the feeling I get out of that, like, the very personal dark fable, like, movies, and it being so prescient in terms of, like, the... You know, the themes of fascism that, like, part of the reason that he wanted to make it to just, like, echo, like, Italy in World War II and all of that, as well as Mark Gustafson's, like, last movie, like, the great stop-motion animator, and just, like, a lot of pieces work. Like, yeah, it's probably Pan's Labyrinth, but I have watched this movie, like, way more. It's also kind of... represents those kind of like masterpieces that are on streaming that just kind of like poof away right now too, you know, like it's probably the newest thing on here. Yeah, it's definitely the newest thing on here in terms of which I feel bad about. A lot of that stuff maybe we'll talk about in 5 years, but it hits a sweet spot. It's like a great like melancholy movie to put on in the fall. And just like some, like, you know, that incredible like one shot of the animation that they sold like a lot of the trailer on, of just like a lot of interesting blocking and cameras moving here and there. And you know, it kind of led to a lot of like Guillermo's talking about like animation as a you know, as a platform,
yeah,
and
yeah,
you know, like
yeah, just it's a thesis statement as much as anything.
Yeah,
else.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And all the Mexican animation that like came out of it too, because it's basically making studios and shit. So like a lot of good has kind of like come from it, even if like nobody's seen it at this point, it feels like. But yeah, it's a weird one to stand out of the list. But like as I said, like, if I had like I don't know, the Dark Fables needed a spot too. And I don't know, Guillermo's had so many good things.
Yeah.
Like what do I, you know, put on Pacific Rim every once in a while, put on Blade 2, you know, like he's got the pop, he's got like the darker stuff. I don't know. I was not even Guillermo's, but I was thinking about things like The Fall or, you know, even like older, like kind of like Dark Fable-y stuff. Mm-hmm. And like definitely has to be there somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
Moving on to number 6.
All right.
Mm-hmm. Look at, we're moving at a good clip. We got this. We're pros.
I know. This is moving fast.
Yeah. Dave, how about your number 6?
My number buddy? 6 is the most recent movie on my list, and it's I Saw the TV Glow.
Ah, this was shortlist. Yeah. I almost did. Very almost did. Still could. but yeah. I'm not.
I mean, of all the, I have seen some really, really brilliant movies in the last few years, like say post COVID, you know, and when since movies came back, let's say, know, I've seen some just real masterpieces, and a lot of them could easily have been on the list. But this is the one that I still think about. This is the one that still haunts me as a perfect, hyper specific depiction of a feeling, of a longing, of a particular kind of heartache that is almost impossible to describe in words, and this film communicates it. You know, it is the longing for a certain time in your life and for not knowing exactly who you are, but there is comfort in staying up late watching something special and unique with a friend who you kind of know, but maybe is not the safest place to be. You know, it's it is that special, unique feeling of stepping outside the bounds of safety. And
yes,
yeah, it is so many things. It is a vibe, but it is at the same time just a compelling and riveting, what the fuck is going to happen next? Watch. I cannot like the shots and the lighting just cannot leave my brain. I have not been able to get this movie out of my head since watching it. And that's all even before you go into the whole trans aspect of it, you know, beyond being like in any way a social justice piece, it is just such a remarkable mood film that I cannot get out of me. It's in me. It invaded me. It's crazy.
No, I'm so glad it made it in here to talk about. I was mad that it didn't, like, that was probably a number 11 kind of like sitting there. And
it's hard. It's so recent, you know, it's
yeah. But also, like, as you were talking, because like so many, you know, it's a pretty common, like, if you pull back and think of the theme as a broader, like, thing that entices you that is dangerous, right? Like a drug analogy sort of thing. Because you're talking about that, and I'm like, immediately go to the other end of the spectrum, because I always think of the Captain N episode where he's in an amusement park, and it's just like, he can be in this amusement park as much as he wants, but he has to leave. And it's, you know, it's the hackiest way to do that, as opposed to a very personal, well done story that also has that trappings to it.
Yeah
It's so good.
Oh, it's so good.
And
all right,
Weiss.
Okay. Yeah. We can now talk about Wet Hot American Summer.
All right.
anniversary year.
Please lead us off.
Sure. I think this movie has to be here just because of all the things that came from it, right? Like, it. What was this? I think it was 2001, and nothing felt like this level of absurdist. Yeah. Like this David Wayne, like and it was kind of like that era where there was this freedom to just be like, oh, we're gonna be meta in this interesting way, or we're just gonna take these tangents.
Yeah
right.
Yeah, nothing like, else is doing satire quite like this, not yep. only at this time, but very few filmmakers do satire quite like David Wayne does. It's a very unique mm-hmm. feeling.
Absolutely. Yeah, I really want to see. I mean, he just had a movie like in the last month, and
which is why I rewatched Wet Hot within the past week yes. or so, because I did go out to see Gail Daughtry in the Celebrity
Oh,
Sex
you did.
Tape.
Okay.
I have not laughed so hard in a public place in
Fuck
probably
yeah.
years.
Man, I gotta see that.
Gail Daughtry was everything I think I kind of hoped Naked Gun would be last year, because
okay.
Naked Gun, well, I didn't not enjoy Naked Gun, but it really begged the comparison, like, they are both satires of like film genre. They're satires mm-hmm. of the language of film, but yep. What are they satirizing? And at what level of meta are they doing it? And it's hard to describe what David Wayne and the State crew, you know, the way that they do it is so smart. And
yep.
And Wet Hot, by comparison, it's I didn't want to say rewatching it. It's not that mm-hmm. it hedges its bets, but it definitely takes its time to show you what kind of movie it is. Mm-hmm. Gail Daughtry, and you'll see this, kind of lets you know immediately what you're getting into, which is great, which is totally fine.
Yeah,
whereas
yeah.
Wet Hot, for the first 10 minutes or so, you could be fooled into thinking that this is just sort of an earnest celebration of a Porky's style
yeah.
teen sex
yeah,
comedy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Until you start to notice that it's using that same flower pot crash sound effect
yes.
for anything that gets thrown.
yep.
And then you start to think, like, wait, what's going on here? It creeps up on you very slowly. And I don't think I don't think it's a deliberate hedge to try and fool a general audience into seeing mm-hmm. something that it's not. I think it's just, I don't know. Yeah.
Well, I mean, honestly, it might just be difference of like attention span of both the audience and the writer at this point too. You know,
yeah.
like 2001, you're just sort of like, okay, we take our time, we set the ground
yeah.
rules, and now it's just sort of like,
let's get into it.
Okay,
no time to
let's
waste.
Get into it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, like
in the third trailer of the movie that is on YouTube, you know, mm-hmm. Then the whole thing is shown.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, and I've watched They Came Together like so many times at this point. Like,
see, I have not rewatched.
They Come
it
Together,
recently.
Yeah. They Come Together is it holds up, and it's much like Walk Hard is just. It
I almost
breaks.
Put Walk Hard on my list.
Yep, that was up there too. Walk Hard and Black Dynamite are always in the same like slot and almost yeah. in there, but. But in all three of those, you know, in all of those cases, it kind of breaks a genre. Because, like, I can't watch a rom-com without thinking of that movie.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
it's so pinpoint and precise
yes.
and, like, you know, like, jokes. Like, it's not broad strokes of the genre. It's just sort of like,
no.
oh, no, this is your perspective. Like, he's very good at being like, oh, this is how you view that very specific thing that always happens in these movies
yes.
that you noticed, you know.
Mm-hmm. And that's and you know, specificity is always the key to greatness. But and it mm-hmm. is because those observations about the tropes are so razor sharp and so hyper specific that mm-hmm. they land so well. And that is just as true of Wet Hot. As it is of all of their collective output ever since. And yeah, it just it makes me want to go back and rewatch the follow-up series as well. And
Yeah, they took those documentaries off of Netflix at some point, because the 10 Years Later documentary was really good too, because that was track that down if you can, because they filmed, there was a ton of behind the scenes stuff when they were making Wet Hot.
Yeah,
it's super cool.
And so many great stories from that. Like, I constantly hear stories from filming that movie, because all of them were it was not a star maker movie necessarily, but mm-hmm. like all the stars in that movie before they were huge, making their first mm-hmm. big turns. And I think director Akiva Schaffer of The Lonely Island saying that he mm-hmm. remembers seeing it at Sundance and thinking, second guessing Paul Rudd's place in the movie, because he had only ever seen him in a drama. And then the minute mm. Paul Rudd starts throwing away his lunch tray, he's like, oh, I get, okay, this guy's legit. Nope, he's got the goods.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing. Yeah, just yep, seminal right. film.
Yeah.
Yeah, given I was late to Clueless, that was what I, yeah, that was Paul Rudd to me.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. My number six is mm-hmm. The Avengers. Marvel's The Avengers.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. That's my only Marvel movie on here. Sure. Go figure. It's still something very special about that first Avengers movie mm-hmm. to me. It's hard to remember a time when the cinematic universe didn't seem like a thing that was actually going to work or come together mm-hmm. or just be like, no, the wheels are going to come off this thing. They're not going to make an Iron Man, Thor, Captain America movie and then tie them all together and into Avengers movie. That's nonsense. Mm-hmm. That they'll never get there. Like, you know, you'd read rumors about that, like on the internet. And it's just like, nah, this is just nonsense. And then it actually all came together mm-hmm. and was really awesome and special to me as a fan of comic books and having seen all those movies. And, you know, just mm-hmm. it's still the promise of the Marvel Cinematic Universe coming together in, you know, not excluding like the ones that kind of work as standalone movies, which is fewer and fewer of them as time goes mm-hmm. on. But the promise of like multiple movies and characters and storylines coming together in one place and paying off is, you know, that's mm-hmm. Anything after that, like there are high points, but it's mostly kind of like, okay, this is a decent step on the way to the next thing, and then the next thing is a decent step on the way to the next thing, and so on and so forth. Mm. You know, and then getting to the end of it and feeling like, you know, anything was possible. Here we are like 15 years later.
I know.
And they just had to buy more companies to make more movies and keep this thing going. And
it's interesting the way you put that as in terms of the other movies having high points and low points, because I think you may be right that Avengers might be kind of the most solid across the board, even though, like, in my mind, I don't know if there's anything in particular that stands out about it as much as the highest points of from like Civil War or Winter Soldier, or on the other end, Endgame and Infinity War. But like when you think about it, it might be the film with the best dialogue. It might be the film with the best mm-hmm. character interaction. It probably is all those things steadily throughout.
Yeah. And you know, I think I'm lower on the bigger event movies, like post the original event, like,
yeah,
I like that first Avengers more than Civil War, Winter Soldier, etc. Like,
yes.
And you know,
clearly because those aren't on the list for me.
Oh yeah. I know. It's just, and also this was the last one made before the Disney buyout, right?
Like, this was the first one made.
It was Disney, happening,
but you know, they didn't have control yet. This is where the ship was going, and then after that was when Disney, this made $1 billion and Disney was like, oh yeah, okay, let's go.
And it was really satisfying. Like those first, you know, four movies were very different, and then they all came together in a lovely way. Like it's hard, you know, like feeling how I do now and just remembering like the energy that it just had, especially at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. That's because it never, I think really Guardians of the Galaxy was very good. Felt very good about Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you know, that was like a couple. Yeah. It never really, it was all lesser from there. There were high points still. There's still ones that I enjoy.
Well, I think it is. I mean, I think you can arguably be. I think what I mean about the characters and the dialogue is that you know, Joss Whedon doing his thing and writing a found family.
Oh yeah, that
story.
Guy.
Yes, that
right.
guy.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like this maybe was one of the few in sort of that mainline Avengers story that was not one of the sort of, I don't know, the more extraneous side movies that felt like it had a real authorial voice. Mm-hmm, in the same way that some of the other ones outside kind of the main tree trunk did. Mm-hmm. You know, Black Panther feels like it's got its own authorial voice. The Taika Waititi's, you know, Thor movies feel like they have a voice. And this was kind of the mainline event, Captain America / Avengers, that felt like it had its own voice. I guess you could say the original Iron Man 2, you know, has...
Yeah, well, I remember that reading, like, interviews at the time that, like, Whedon still had to, like, convince Disney to put money into certain things. Like, the big shot of all the Avengers coming together. He's like, right. no, I know this costs a lot of money, but we have to do this because this is why we are making this movie for moments and shots like this. And it was only, you know, six characters, like, six heroes.
Standing in frame together.
Yeah, actually on screen together and not by, you know, Age of Ultron was still kind of small. And then, of course, you get to Infinity War and Endgame and there's a billion characters to try to like bring together. And the way that they were filming them was like, no, everybody has to be like in their own green screen booth and can't talk to each other to keep everything secret and make sure the performances are as like bland as or static as possible or, you know, whatever. Just like it's still the high point for Marvel movies and superhero movies. Well, not superhero movies, but not even Marvel movies necessarily, but the Marvel Cinematic Universe, we'll say.
Yeah.
For me. That still holds a special place for me.
Yeah, and if we're talking about, you know, the movies from 2000 to present, yeah, like it is a large part of the landscape. Like so it's good to be in there.
Number 5, getting down to top 5. Mm-hmm. We've only been here an hour. We're killing it.
I know.
Weiss, number 5.
Oh, shufflings again. numbers are getting arbitrary at this point. I put down Old Boy on this one. Kind of the only, I don't have too many dark things in here. And also, like, there's a couple Park Chan-wook movies that I would like to rewatch, especially like The Handmaiden, that like might be better. It feels a little like over time it has kind of gotten much like Fight Club or whatever. It does feel like it's gotten a reputation of being like bro-y film guy kind of movie, but also it's so well done. Like everything he does is such a beautiful like waltz of a film, and this was kind of like the start of like the elegance of those movies, like really at least hitting like U.S. shores and getting international attention. And he's, you know, still making like no other choice. It's still incredible movie. Could be put against it. Yeah. It's a nasty piece of work. And like, once you kind of know the steps, like, you know, you're also like waiting for thing to happen. But like, I always use the word lush with his movies. There's just something about like the color schemes and the way things are put together and the waltz like music that he tends to gravitate towards, even in these very dark kind of stories. And of course the hammer fight that, like, you know, even up to the Furious has a hammer fight, you know, like it is kind of like another language of film that has been put in, you know, like whether people know it or not, like the man popping out of the suitcase in the middle of a field, like there's images that are kind of like in the zeitgeist that came from this. That's kind of, I don't know about forgotten, but like not talked about as much at this point. But I'm glad that, you know, Park Chan-wook is still like a top name up there, especially as like we're getting more like Asian directors of renown in the auteur, you know, like your Bong, you know, Bong Joon-ho getting popular has kind of brought like Park Chan-wook up a little bit in that sense to a lot of audience. But yeah, and that was one that like fucking I watched the movie the first time, I just kind of like sat there like just kind of taking it all in. It's very comes together in a very satisfying, sad gut punch of a way, but it's a very tight script in that sense too. As dark as it'd be, it's a hard one to recommend. In that sense, you do have to go in sort of knowing it's gonna go some places, but yeah, it's a good bad good time. Oh boy.
All right, so my number five. I ran into a problem. I think it was while Dave was talking about, I saw the TV glow where I realized that I had forgotten something on my list, and then walked into a real conundrum with what was going on here at number five. Because so originally I had written down this as being Star Wars The Last Jedi. And then the thought crossed my mind. I'm just like, oh, is there a better Rian Johnson movie that I like more from the past 25 years? And I said, oh, shit, I forgot about Knives Out.
I just did a rewatch of that one too. What a fucking great movie.
And I'm just like, yeah, that it is.
Should I really change like Old Boy to Knives Out?
But I'm like, Knives Out should probably be on this list.
Well, it's tough, right? Because it's the judge, like, what is a better movie, but what means more to you? You know, it's.
Yes. So, you know, Last Jedi, I'm assuming I'm not like raining on anyone else's parade by talking about The Last Jedi a little bit here. It is, you know, my favorite of the Star Wars movies that we got in this century, which I guess also includes the tail end of the prequel trilogy, but that's fine. And that, you know, it's Last Jedi is also the most maddening Star Wars movie because it is so divisive for the fan base, and it made everything, every conversation about any Star Wars thing after it horrible, because it just seemed to harden people along, let's say, some kind of ideological lines, and not just about Star Wars, about other issues as well. You know, the Last Jedi started steering the Star Wars ship in a different direction than it had been before. And to me, that was very, very exciting and interesting. That I really looked forward to seeing where it would go in the future. And that is not where things went afterwards. and, you know, the whole cohesion of the sequel trilogy is just a mess because they had no endpoint definitive story they wanted to tell in mind. You know, Force Awakens is this great, like, you know, reintroduction to the series that was fun and exciting and not very risky. And then this like felt risky, like, okay, like we're changing some perspectives. We're setting some things up. There's a lots of places we can go in the future. And then Rise of Skywalker happened. But there's just like a lot of great, interesting Star Wars lore stuff in there that I really, really appreciate. And other people don't, but I, you know, rewatching it, and I have rewatched it. And when I did rewatch it, I'm like, no, this movie is awesome and beautiful. And has still some scenes that aren't that great. And some choices, it's certainly some things about it are awkward, you know, but I just growing pains, but Knives Out, that is a movie you can pop on anytime and have a good time.
Yeah. That's a good time movie.
that yep. it is so fun. I mean, you know, and there's a reason that has spawned like, you know, multiple mm-hmm. sequels at this point. But that first one is just so well constructed and well mm-hmm. acted. And oh, Daniel Craig's here on my list again.
yep.
Like, it's just so wonderfully written and designed, the way the reveals of it unfurl, and Chris Evans is on this list again, being a huge dickaroo on here. just a fantastic classic, like, mm-hmm. you know, even though it has sequels, but, you know, standalone movie,
yeah.
that's just, it's so good.
As someone who always thought mm-hmm. Rian Johnson was a very interesting filmmaker for years before Star Wars, Knives Out, I've always said that Knives Out was kind of just like finally the movie that he was always destined to make. Mm-hmm. To me, it feels like the absolute apotheosis of everything he does well and everything he does intelligently as a filmmaker and as someone who clearly loves the art form and fills it with a joy and a reverence. Mm-hmm. Like, as a fan of movies, like, Rian Johnson's a fan of film. You know, he does it because he loves it, and you can tell that in this movie more than I think anything else he's ever made.
Yeah, and just having gone back to it in the last, like, month too, like, it hit at the time for like the politics and the immigrant story, yeah, but yeah. like now is even more, you're just like, holy shit, he was the only one like talking about this in
yeah.
2018, I think that was 2018 and
mm-hmm. 2019
or 2019, yep.
Yep,
cool. And it's just like, it yeah, the, you know, the Nazi child masturbating in the bathroom, like all of it. Yeah, everything works. Everything hits as well as it did that first time.
Yeah, it's a
yeah.
fucking movie for grownups that is as fun as any. That's, I get when we, because we showed it within the past year to our teenager, and she immediately loved it because mm-hmm. it's just an extraordinarily, not only a well-constructed movie, but at the mm-hmm. same time, a well-plotted and well-written movie that is yep. just yep. so fun to watch moment to moment. It's irresistible. Yeah. It is mm-hmm. such an excellent movie.
Yeah, I do yeah. appreciate that Rian Johnson took the backlash to The Last Jedi and just decided to just keep needling right wingers for
yep.
the next three movies. Just always has to stick a few knives in them. Dave, you're number five.
My number five is my most pretentious film that I think I'm going to discuss in my top 10. And it's Paul Thomas Anderson's The Master.
Hey, all right.
I don't know that I could necessarily argue that it's Paul Thomas Anderson's best movie, but I do think it's my personal favorite. Mm-hmm. To me, it might be because for me, it is just an incredibly masterful showcase of two acting performances that mm-hmm. I that I will never forget. Two yep. unforgettable acting performances portraying like two just incredibly different types of individuals who are both so far from my own personal experience, mm-hmm. but who are also instantly recognizable in this sort of milieu that PTA works in, where he examines power dynamics between people, who has power, who is really in control, who is, and maybe that's because, you know, the master is a bit mm-hmm. is the most on the nose about mm-hmm. what he tends to make movies about, that he really gets to just have these, have Philip Seymour Hoffman and Joaquin Phoenix be master and servant, and who is really in control, and who affects who, and it is my favorite Joaquin Phoenix performance. It is his most, I think, vulnerable and pathetic, and is again just one of these singular characters on film, the likes of which I have never seen before or since. That is a perfect combination of the role as written and then inhabited by this particular actor in casting, is mm-hmm. is so specific, so hyper specific, and so unique. And it's a movie that I have not seen since its release, but it's also a movie that I will never forget.
Remember when we went on a date to see that?
And you were pointing, that was, I remember now you like even talking about like the format in which it had been shot, which at that time to me was like new information. I was like, wait, what does that mean?
Oh, because it was 70.
And I could see it, and like I appreciated being educated, because I think you were you pointed out some like a couple of shots where there's just some really expansive vistas.
Gorgeous.
I had forgotten about that until just now, so thank you for reminding me.
I feel like I don't know, there's a lot of my next one is just like, I don't know, like seeing with some of our crew, I suppose, thinking about that stuff. But like I don't know, this one was on my list, and similarly I haven't gone back to since. Like I saw I didn't see There Will Be Blood until after The Master. And The Master is my favorite of the serious Paul Thomas, and probably in general, but like definitely of the more serious Paul Thomas Andersons. Like I've through the years, I've kind of gravitated towards the instead of interesting character, interesting relationships, where I'm just sort of and what's more, you know, anytime those two are on screen together, like the only movie I can think that's even close to is The Lighthouse at this point, because it makes me think of like two people locked in a room going back and forth, and like
two people locked in a room but locked in a life together. Locked in an intractable relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's another power dynamic sort of thing. Yeah, it's just like riveting performances. Probably top performance for sure.
Yeah, yep.
Good That's stuff.
The Master.
Yeah. Master.
All right. Number fours.
Yeah.
All right, and we're starting with me.
All right.
This is this is my most recent movie on this list. An incredible post-World War II movie that just happens to involve Godzilla.
I wasn't sure.
Godzilla Minus One.
Yes, very much on my long list as well.
Holy shit, they just keep making better and better Godzilla movies. Like this century, it's like, you know, when we did our top 10 of all time, Final Wars was on there. That was before Shin Godzilla had come out, and I was like, which I had a really funny moment like looking through like old blank of the year lists and whatever, and I came across Godzilla Redemption or something like that. It was like the American name for Shin Godzilla. I forgot what, and I was like, what the fuck Godzilla movie was that? I don't remember seeing that. And then I was like, oh, nobody calls it that literally anymore. But yeah, Minus One, holy crap, what a movie that is. And it is, because it is a post-war movie focused on this failed kamikaze pilot who, you know, basically just chickens out, which is a reasonable thing to do, and comes back home in shame, and everybody knows that it's like, you shouldn't be here, like you just kind of bullshitted it, and now you're back and seeing, you know, what just Japan trying to bring itself back together, like in the aftermath of the war. Just the way it ties into Godzilla, you know, coming out, and, you know, Godzilla has always been centered around, or at least in its origin story, is always centered around, you know, nuclear testing or whatever. And it feels like, you know, Jaws at points, especially when they're on the boat, obviously. Mm-hmm. But it's just such a well-constructed disaster movie.
Yeah. Can I splinter off of that for just a second and say, I think that this movie is maybe the perfect exemplar of how a monster movie in particular has strengths over merely a disaster movie, because they both pit humanity against an intractable force, right? The huge, impossible, intractable force is there to expose humanity's frailties and also their strengths. But a monster movie, there is something inherently different when that intractable force has a will. Not even necessarily an intelligence or a personality per se, but it's different when it is a being with a will as opposed to a natural disaster, you know,
a tsunami,
a tsunami or a hurricane or a, you know, there is something, I can't put my finger on it, but.
Well, in one sense you could, I mean, back to, you know, like you can have a relationship with a monster, you know, like somebody can, you're going to react, you know. You can have a glint in the eye of Bruce or Godzilla or whatever, but like a tsunami, you're like, well, fuck that. You know, like it's still nature. It's ever present sort of thing. It's just a different threat. I don't know. Like, yeah. And I've never really liked disaster movies for the most part. And like monster movies rule.
That's a great way to put it, is that you can have a relationship, because it's not like Godzilla particularly has a personality in this movie, you know, in the ways that some of the campier older films, perhaps did. Mm-hmm. And yet you're right. It is, because it is a being with a will. It's something that the protagonists can have a relationship with. It's an important distinction, I think. So, Tim, thank you for letting me splinter off there. Please.
Yeah, absolutely. And something, you know, this is common in Shin Godzilla as well, is, you know, solving the Godzilla problem, you know, of those movies is based around, you know, Japan as a country trying to rally limited resources to solve the problem. It's not just like, oh, here's some high-tech science fiction military solution. You know, there isn't another monster. There is not a Mecha Godzilla we are sending to fight the Godzilla. It's like, okay, we have to use the resources we have when our country is crippled in some way, shape, or form. And in Shin Godzilla, that is the Department of Public Works, more or less.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, the limited resources they have post-World War II. You know, this is a movie that was made on a $10 million budget. Looks incredible. Insane. Like, just the monster looks amazing, you know, made money hand over fist. And, you know, there's a reason why it's getting a direct sequel, which not many Godzilla movies do. And I cannot wait.
Masterful film. Love this movie.
Dave.
My number four, we mentioned it earlier. It is Jake Kasdan's Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox story.
All right. All right.
Yeah. A big reason this movie is, I had several movies on my long list that have stuck in my heart and mind because of their soundtracks. In a way, this is a stand-in for a lot of them, but I also made a point of rewatching it within the past couple of days, and good God, does it hold up? It's so funny. It is hilarious. And it is also a comedy that is distinctly for adults. You know, a mindset on social media seems to be where younger viewers seem to be like, an epidemic of people feeling uncomfortable with sex scenes in movies. But this movie, and as well as you could, I think, say this about David Wayne's comedies, too. Take the right and correct view that we are adults and sex can be funny. It is a part of life. It is very much a part of life and can be very funny. And so this movie, I did not remember all the full frontal nudity in Walk Hard until I rewatched it.
Yeah.
And very, very narrowly watched it with my children also.
Okay.
very narrowly escaped that. But another reason why it is so high on my list is because it is a comedy about music and about the history of music and the music industry, and is such a, it, like Wet Hot American Summer, it is a satire of a specific style of movie. And like Wet Hot American Summer, while its particular insights are maybe not as razor sharp smart as David Wayne's, they are consistently funny. They are, you never feel like it is banging you on the head with, hey, we're making fun of this now. And a parade of celebrities doing impressions of, and it is a period piece, which is to its advantage. You know, it is about the, you know, development of rock and roll history. And so even as the movie ages, this point in music history will always remain important and relevant. And so it is always fertile ground to go back and explore and have fun with. So like the fact that it is a parody of biopics becomes less important as it is a comedic tour through musical history. I think in the same way that people maybe love Mel Brooks's History of the World Part One, that it's a tour of general knowledge about something that is hilarious. The songs are incredible. That's the other thing about musical comedies is that the songs have to be good for them to work. And these songs are all great. They're so good. You know, I didn't get the chance to rewatch Tenacious D and The Pick of Destiny, which is another soundtrack that is really fantastic. I suspect it's not as good a movie as Waka, because it turns out that Walk Hard remains a really, really great comedy. And again, I think the reason why being a satire, I ended up, you know, thinking real hard about why did I feel disappointed with Naked Gun? And I wonder if part of it is that the leads, Liam Neeson and Pam Anderson, God bless them, and maybe Liam Neeson in particular, I think there's something about their performances that are afraid to look vulnerable and ridiculous. Liam Neeson is playing tough cops so straight that he very rarely gets comically vulnerable in the way that John C. Reilly does when he is high off his mind on PCP, naked, running around the streets, like screaming his head off. There's something about that very primal vulnerability that touches on a very primal sense of comedy that I think other films lacked. Like Walk Hard walks fucking hard. It walks all the way there.
I was probably the scene that I think about the most is the one that is vulnerable in Naked Gun, which is the Pam Anderson singing scene. Like, that was the scene that she wasn't afraid to look silly. Like the scatting, the just going full force.
Oh, forgive me. I'm struggling to remember.
That's it. I mean, it's Walk Hard is on this list. Naked Gun is not. I was also just in the musical comedy sense, like it didn't quite make my list, but I was also thinking, like, just rewatched A Mighty Wind, and A Mighty Wind is so good, and the music makes it. And happy for all the Parker Posey love of late right now.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Walk Hard.
Yeah, I think it's just, it's, you know, this movie is almost 20 years old. That's what I was gonna say. It's like this got in quick as like musical biopics were like kind of taking off as a thing.
Only Johnny Cash but Ray, if you remember, because they both came out about the same time.
Yeah, it was like those both came out, and then someone was like, okay, we're making fun of this right now. But they keep making musical biopics, so the movie remains relevant.
Yeah.
Yeah, because they still all feel them. Like that.
Like, it got out there, you know, before, you know, just even before it was, like, obvious to start making the jokes.
Yeah.
It's like, we are going to start making these jokes right now, like, and they're just going to keep making these movies. And... yeah, just get out of here, Dewey. You don't want none of this. And I have no fucking sense of smell. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a pill that gives you a boner. There's no side effects.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Really, just really well written. Oh, yeah.
Cut in half great. Real bad. Yep. Cut in
half. You got a real bad case of getting cut in half.
Hang on, I gotta let my dog in.
Oh, all right. Yeah, we.
Oh, it's my turn. All right, this one kind of like holds the place for, I guess, a couple things, and this is the Pixar slot. And I'm not generally through the years I've gone with the Incredibles, and I love the Incredibles. Mm-hmm. This time I went with Ratatouille.
Very close to making my list.
I think like my top three of the Pixars with those two and WALL-E. Like, kind of are the same slot, really.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
What are we talking about?
So, we're doing Pixar slot, and I took a swerve and I went with Ratatouille this time.
Okay. All right.
Mm-hmm. So, still in the Brad Bird wheelhouse.
Yep.
Iron Giant can't make it on this list. and it's like, you can't escape. Like that Ratatouille is now shorthand for a very specific funny thing that is part of culture that everybody knows. I mean, yes, because of Everything Everywhere All at Once, but also because of the power of a very specific premise that is so crazy that they could not get to work until like the last minute, much like, you know, like Toy Story and Toy Story 2 and like a lot of like... great movies that like once they found it and threw everything into it, it's such a beautiful, romantic, earnest movie.
Yeah.
It's also kind of like between Ratatouille and WALL-E, because they were so close together, like that's like peak Pixar to me. Like that's So
those two are also my two favorite Pixar movies, and Ratatouille does just just barely edges out WALL-E.
WALL-E was what I was going to put on the list, so wheelhouse there. Yeah,
yeah, totally.
Yep, yep.
Yeah, Ratatouille somehow becomes this not only a an Anthony Bourdain-ish love letter to fine cuisine. Like, if you are a foodie, there's a lot to love. In Ratatouille, I will go out on a limb and say it really benefits from having a non-voice actor, non-actor, really, in one of the main lead important roles. It sort of brings the perfect sense of innocence to Linguini. I forget the fella's name. I just know that he is not an actor by trade.
And he worked at Pixar, right? Or am I
think
wrong?
So. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And somehow delivers like this really winning and earnest performance that does not feel performative, which is so essential, because everyone else in this movie is doing a voice or an accent or I mean, but even Patton Oswalt, this is one of his most honest, earnest human performances, ironically. Arguably. And and it is romantic, isn't it? Gosh, it's hard not to get swept up in the place and the feeling and the relationships. Mm-hmm.
And just the Paris-ness of it. And I don't know. And
my favorite Paris movie? Maybe my favorite Paris movie.
I have to think about that.
He has like six voice acting credits, but Ratatouille is the most recent one.
Okay.
He did not like, oh, I did great in Ratatouille, I'm going to be a voice actor now. Like, no, he just stayed doing behind the scenes stuff.
Yeah.
And also, and all the credits in the animation like the art department and the animation departments. Yeah. Yeah, no, and I haven't seen that one in so long, but I listened to that, you know, that soundtrack is like one of, you know, I'm sure we've got beautiful a couple of Michael Giacchino's in there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That gets regular play in my household. It could very easily have been in my top 10. It is one of Jana's very favorite movies of all time, which is another reason why we play it more frequently around here. Yeah, we all love it. We did so much love for Ratatouille around here. Great pick.
Yep. Thank you. Yeah. Fantastic. Had to get something in that vein.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Number threes, top threes.
We're up to threes.
We start with Dave.
Okay.
Number three. Yeah.
My number three is my very favorite Gore Verbinski movie, and it's Rango. Oh,
Rango. Yeah. All right. Yeah.
And you know, I know that we have talked about Rango a lot over the years and how much we love Rango, so there's very little else to say beyond
I didn't see Rango until, I don't know, like when my kid was like, not in the last 5 years, but say the last 6 years, maybe like pandemic era. Yeah. Like, I don't know, at some point. Well, it's like he got a big collection of DVDs from grandma, and that was in there. So like Rango came up. So I was very late to the party, but this movie fucking rules.
Oh my
Doesn't
God.
It?
This movie fucking
yeah.
rules.
It's so good.
you know, we have waxed poetic about the beautifully ugly character design. I would love to just sort of say, reiterate once again that it is an all ages movie that does not condescend to its audience and sort of embraces its subject matter with a lot of earnestness and celebrates what is fun and interesting about its setting, rather than subverting or poking fun at it. This is not a movie that feels like it needs to make fun of what Westerns are. It celebrates why we love Westerns. And it is thus becoming in and of itself a really good Western movie.
it's much has been said about it. I'm sure we have too, but like they took Chinatown and made an ugly Western out of it. Like, it's literally Chinatown. And they're like, here you go. Here's your kid's movie.
Yeah. I mean,
and it worked.
It totally works because plot-wise, this is, oh boy. We'll talk about this later, I guess. But there's a real art to taking a plot that is complex and has sophisticated, nuanced adult motivations that kids might not necessarily understand, and making those things legible and readable to a kid just by plot beats, just by making characters' intentions clear and visible. Like, you don't need to understand the economics of the situation to understand, you know, why the bad guy wants what he wants, because that is made clear through the performance. It's made clear through the art. You know, if it is, and that is a real subtle and difficult thing to do, but it's something that I think film in particular is a medium that excels at that kind of storytelling. And so it is a great film that is able to do that.
Yeah.
Love Rango. Love Rango so much.
Yeah. Rango's so good. Like, I remember it came out, I want to say around the same time as like the Coen brothers, like True Grit, because they both had like the like younger, like female protagonist, like Western vibe thing going on, and I'm just sort of like, okay, well, these are both like
respecting the
audience's intelligence version of that, and I'm just like, let's go.
Can't believe I don't have a Coen Brothers movie on my list.
Same. I was like, there's plenty that could go that I like. My favorite, well, I mean these days I could put a serious man. Like, once I got to, like, did really rock it up the list. But I need to see it more.
Yeah. Personally. God, I'd love to go back and see that. I loved that movie when I saw it.
Yeah.
All right. That's my number three. Weiss.
All right. This is, I wasn't sure if you were going to put this here, Dave, and I guess it could still show up on your list, but I put Royal Tenenbaums on this one.
It will be on my list, yes.
Yeah, okay. I figured that was. All
right, yeah. I figured we're getting close to that one.
Yeah, we're getting down to the, things are conjoining here. My number three, which maybe could have been my number one. I can't believe nobody else wouldn't have one of these on here. Fellowship of the Ring.
Do we just talk about each other's at this point? Because that's that will be my number two. So let's just.
Okay. If that's your number two, then we'll just flow into this here. Fellowship. Ring.
Rings. Yeah. Yep. And specifically Fellowship for me as well.
Yeah. Yeah, that's still the best single movie, but you know, I don't watch one without watching the others. Mm-hmm. That is a regular watch in this house, like at least once a year. We watch through all of them, all of the extended versions. Even though I think Two Towers is the only one that's definitively made better by the extended cut, personally. Mm. But the other ones are just made longer with more stuff, and that's fine. But Fellowship of the Ring, a boy, they don't make them how they used to. Even Peter Jackson doesn't make them how he used to.
I know.
It's the perfect, you know, comedy. They made so much stuff for this movie in terms of character models and props and costumes and weapons and everything, and there is obviously a lot of digital effects in there, you know, when needed, but also mainly to enhance scenes and just make things look a little better. But
it is hard to watch the cave troll, like, I will give you that.
That,
like,
does stand out now.
It stands out, but like, who cares?
The design of it is still,
yes.
it just stands out to our eyes now that it's like, oh, okay. Yeah. I mean, the Balrog still looks amazing. My eyes just look, oh my gosh. It's just such, just what a movie, and and just that Peter Jackson's passion was there for it more so than it was making the Hobbit movies. It feels like,
The passion, tone, like what nails tone better than like just the second that movie starts, the warm blanket.
Yeah. The score to it, the lighting, the scenery, everything about it just draws you into this amazing, magical fantasy universe. And everybody is so invested in their parts, in their roles, because you know, they filmed all three of them back to back to back to back over the course of a year or so. So which is just crazy. So they're just and then you just didn't really have to do much else with the rest of your lives, really. You're just coasting from there. But just absolute classic movies. You know, it feels like the last of how things used to be made, at least at that scope. No one, it feels, well, apparently Christopher Nolan would. I haven't seen The Odyssey yet, but
such perfect time, like it, we needed that level of escapism right after 9/11. Like that was a big part of like why those like took off. And you know, one of those, like the same way Night of the Living Dead was like right after MLK, of just sort of like it just struck right there and it's there forever.
It's what I mainly think of when I think of, you know, Lord of the Rings. I've read the books, obviously. Or maybe that's not obvious, but you know, I've read the books. But when I think of like what the characters look like and the scenes and how everything looks, it's like I'm thinking of those movies because he just nailed it so perfectly. And I think that, you know, that remains the touchstone of, you know, when the Lego sets that they put out for Lord of the Rings now, like it's based on the movie's designs. It's not like somebody is imagining afresh what these what Minas Tirith might look like for a Lego set. It's like, no, that's just what it looked like in the movies. Like it is just kind of de facto become visual canon for what Middle Earth looks like is those movies. Because I feel like if you kind of diverge from that now, it's, you know, you get dissonance.
Yeah.
Like you can only, well,
knock off.
You can only go so far. Yeah, knock off feeling a little bit. You can can with the characters. The characters don't have to. Well, that's debatable. But but so much is just like, well, if it doesn't look like the Jackson movies, like is, you know, doesn't look like it's not Lord of the Rings.
I wish I loved these movies as much as everyone did. I have the utmost respect for them, and they are inarguably the definitive fantasy epics of the modern era. But they just never sunk into my heart in the way that they did for a lot of people. That's a personal issue for me. For me, they always suffered from what I call the Godfather problem, is that I feel like I can feel the film using cinematic language to skip over pages and pages of literary story. To me, that feeling is too palpable. But I don't have a better solution for it. I'm not saying there's a way to do that any better. It's an impossible task, and he arguably did it better than anyone else. To be fair, I've always
because I feel like when you add in too much of that, it drags down the movie. Like it drags down the pacing. Like, cause some of that, you know, I feel like gets added back in the extended cuts. And it just, you know,
and that's what I wonder if the extended cuts are maybe going to be the version for me. I have not have found the time to sit down and watch all the extended cuts, even though I've always wanted to, because I'm wondering if maybe that extra padding and that slower pace is what I'm looking for.
It's definitely, I have not gone back to theatrical since theatrical. Yeah. Like the extended editions are just what those movies are to me. So it's hard to like break them apart. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I vaguely will remember be like, oh, right. Well, yeah. It actually is tough for me to parse at this point. Like what is extended cut and what it was in there. Sometimes I'm like, okay, I don't think this part was some things stand out more. So again, in Two Towers, because that's my favorite of the extended cuts and whatever. Yeah, so I guess we're on to number twos, which we already heard about Weiss's. Which...
I mean, you know, Dave will talk. You know.
I mean, we can... We can just talk about it now, because there's no...
Is your number two Tenenbaums, Dave?
My number one is the Royal Tenenbaums.
Okay, well, then we'll get there.
We're fine.
All right.
We'll do my number two here.
Yeah, there we go.
And then we'll do your number two as well, even though I just talked a bunch. All right. My number two is Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. You knew it was coming.
Okay.
Yeah,
I wasn't.
You weren't sure it was going to be this or something else.
Yeah, definitely on my long list, and I am. That's another like directorial team that I'm like, I can't believe they didn't make it onto my list because I love everything they've made. So,
I mean, you know, best Marvel movie, best Spider-Man movie, best animated movie, like. It was the second movie my child saw in theaters because he went to see like the Nutcracker or some shit like a couple weeks prior. But you know, took him to see Spider-Verse, and that was a very regular watch on the Blu-ray. That Blu-ray got tons and tons and tons of play. I mean, you know, it's not like a stretch to say, you know, in terms of like animation, that movie was revelatory with like its kind of its style and techniques, and like using different animation styles in single frames and single scenes and having things, having characters move at different frame rates in the second movie, at least. But also, as you know, a Spider-Man story, that it's, you know, everybody knows, you know, the Spider-Man origin story. They've done it twice in movies already at that point. And just like, you're already familiar with this, you know, and the movie plays and leans into that and stars, you know, Miles Morales, who has been increasingly, gaining profile in just general Spider-Man, what have you, since his introduction, you know, some 15 years ago or so. Mm-hmm. It's just like, you know, such a great story. You know, it is a superhero movie, but, you know, it's about the kid Miles, like, you know, finding himself and his place and who he is within that Spider-Man universe. Like, the whole movie is about him becoming Spider-Man while watching all these other spider people, you know, who have already found themselves, do their thing. Mm-hmm. And then finding his own style and putting that together into the movie with a really good soundtrack.
Yes.
That I listened to.
Yep. Still. Yep.
Still. Yeah. Just awesome. Still, you know, still waiting for the end of that trilogy, willing to wait as long as it takes them to make it without them killing themselves.
Right.
I'm totally fine with that. And yeah, Across the Spider-Verse is also incredible. So, yeah.
I would like to also point out that just that it has the confidence to be a Lord and Miller comedy, as sort of defined by a far more naturalistic, hey, we're just real people talking. We're just real people saying funny things and being a little wacky in a very naturalistic kind of way that is what makes their comedy work, their sense of patter. If this movie was like performative in the way that a lot of animated movies can be, where we're putting on voices, it would not click, and like those relationships would not feel nearly as grounded, because this is a movie about forging relationships, losing relationships. It's a deeply emotional movie while being really, really funny at the same time. Which Lord and Miller are quickly making a stock and trade in.
I mean, even, you know, Ed, I hadn't seen Clone High until like much later, but it is kind of crazy to see like their first like thing.
I still have not seen
it. You know, it's cool, especially keeping in mind like Spider-Man of just like kids in high school, like talking, like in some ways it's the same thing, just like, you know, with this huge budget and like, you know, more just a different artistic like sense of like on the visual side and all that shit. But you know, there is a clear through line, you know, from Spider-Man to Project Hail Mary to everything. It definitely has the auteur fingerprint to it.
Yeah, I mean, Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs had a place on my long list because it's one of my personal, like, one of those movies we watched before they were Lord and Miller, and really was like, wait, this is way funnier than it has any right to be. And now, of course, in hindsight, like, oh, okay, sure. And, you know, you know, arguably the Lego Movie is a better movie, you know, could it be the greatest Lord and Miller? Could Spider-Man be the Spider-Verse specifically be? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it might be the best Lord and Miller movie.
Yeah. I think so. I think Lego Movie would be my only competitor personally, but yeah, good team.
Yeah. Good Lord.
Yeah. Dave, what's your number two?
My number two is the Akiva Schaffer comedy, Hot Rod. Akiva Schaffer's directorial film debut. I know I've spent a lot of time on this podcast hating on Naked Gun, but for the most part, I really like Akiva Schaffer. I love his work and the way he describes his process with his Lonely Island cohorts, Yorma Taconi and Andy Samberg. He says I heard him say very recently that, like, even when I'm credited as a director, it's very much a Joel and Ethan Coen thing. It's that, like, the DGA won't credit them as co-directors, so technically they are credited as director and producer, but they're both directing that fucking movie. He said, like, we all direct our films. And Hot Rod is this just wonderful sweet spot in their careers where they were entrusted with making kind of a quintessential SNL comedy that Lorne Michaels sort of trusted them and gave them the advice that, like, he said to them, don't make the movie that you think a studio wants to make. Make the movie mm-hmm. that you want to make. Make the movie that you wish you discovered on cable TV in reruns when you were 13. Because that's the movie that's the audience that's going to find this movie, even if it doesn't do well at the box office. And that's what's going to give it legs and give it life, because that's kind of how SNL movies work. You know, they become these formative movies for someone at age 13.
Yeah.
And Hot Rod is a really incredibly strong film. It's an incredibly strong comedy. Honestly, I didn't really, like, in hindsight, I didn't need Napoleon Dynamite on this list, because Hot Rod is kind of a really earnest character piece about, like, here's a weirdo trying to, you know, here's a mm-hmm. weirdo trying to succeed and trying to get everybody to believe in him. It is an incredibly earnest and winning movie that is also just laugh out loud hilarious. It might be my favorite SNL comedy of all time.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. And I base this again on a very recent couple of rewatches, like not only loving it at the time, but rewatching it very recently within the past year and sort of confirming for myself, like, yeah, no, this movie is really good. Like, they are kind of it is these three guys who are very funny and have produced a lot of very funny work, and have also, you know, produced a lot of not so great work, because SNL gave them the latitude to produce a whole lot of work and iterate very quickly. They got the chance to fail on television a lot with their digital shorts. And so, like, this movie, more than almost anything else that they've made, is the movie that they wanted to make for themselves. It's the movie that cracks them up. And you really feel that. It is a movie that is untouched by studio meddling. It's just a bunch of, it has a very indie, incredibly low budget film, elevated so much by little bits by, like, Bill Hader and fucking, Danny McBride, and, you know, like, again, before they were huge. It's the second movie in a row on my list that stars Isla Fisher in the as an ingenue,
right,
in addition to Rango. The Will Arnett doing just an all-time classic turn as a total dick. The yet another movie in my top five where Chris Parnell has a really great you know, minor role. It is the best of these guys, this comedy troupe, who I think are some of the best comedic filmmakers. I love Alvin and the Chipmunks, and
well, that's
Alvin and the Chipmunks. Oh my God, Chip and Dale.
Chip and Dale. Yeah.
Very different. You heard it here. Dave loves Alvin and the Chipmunks.
And I need to go back to, because, like, neither Hot Rod nor Pop Star hit me as much as others, and it just feels like I'm missing. But Chip and Dale is the one that I'm like, I get it.
Chip and Dale, yeah.
Like, that's fantastic. The one that works for me. Yeah.
I Pop Star is really good, too. I haven't revisited it since, but it also... I hate to put it this way, that it suffers for having a bigger budget, you know, that it doesn't have that very... Hot Rod feels very scrappy. Hot Rod still feels like this just kind of undiscovered indie gem that just very has its own unique sense of humor. There's nothing else quite like it. And I love it. It is a goofball SNL comedy. That's it.
Yep.
All right. Thanks for letting me wax on about it.
No.
That's what we're here for. Yeah, the waxing.
Good. All right. Are we at the number
all
one?
That's left. All that's left is number one.
All right.
And I go first.
Yeah, you go first.
Yeah. How do you want? Yeah. You want to go first? Because, like, this is going to be two pairs of pairing ups, I believe. Yeah. So, just a guess here.
Okay. All right.
But I'm not making assumptions.
All right. Yeah. Number one, it's finally here in first place. It's Speed Racer.
Of course it's Speed Racer. Of course. Yeah. Yeah. Same.
It's the Wachowskis' Speed Racer.
All right. I rewatched it last night.
Yep. Yeah. It is. It has many things have cycled on my Letterboxd for, and Speed Racer is the only one to be steadfast at number one the entire time.
All right. Well, forgive me for wasting a lot of talk about respecting all ages audience and not condescending to them on other movies, because Speed Racer is perhaps the very best case in point for that.
This era of Wachowski, because like, and it's hard to even talk like the problematic favorite that is Cloud Atlas, because like that movie is such an emotional movie with a clear problem like going into it. Everybody is doing different because everybody is playing different like races and sex throughout the movie, so like it's, you have to really prep people, but like Speed Racer and Cloud Atlas back to back is kind of like the height of Wachowski's power at this point. And like, I don't think that there's an ending stronger than the finish line in a Speed Racer.
Oh my God.
Like that last race.
It's incredible.
It's incredible. Every time. And I've gotten to see this in the theater many times, hopefully one, they're playing in the IMAX here this summer, so I'm hoping to get there.
What a fucking heart attack that's gonna be.
It's religious at that point.
It is, but no, I mean that. Yeah. Okay, let's talk about that ending, because it is kind of the one thing. Just rewatching it last night and not having seen it since its release, that ending is the one thing that stands out about that movie in my memory so much. And rewatching it again, it is like it just connects the emotional through line of everything that they established over the course of the movie up until that point, and elevates it to this sublime artistry that mirrors what the dialogue at that point is. They're sort of reiterating Susan Sarandon's lines about how when you race, it's art, it's poetry, and and suddenly, you know, at the same time, this film that you're watching, this over-the-top children's film that is a just visual kaleidoscope becomes art in this moment. And not that it wasn't art before, but you feel it in this moment. It all hits all at once, and you're like, holy shit.
They're so good at that. Oh, go ahead. Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, so, you know, this movie, this was also a heavy repeat watch when Richard was little. And more than anything else, it's like when this movie was on, it was like, well, I'm not getting anything done for the next 2 hours because I'm going to be sitting in the living room, because every scene is amazing in some way, shape or form. But it's like, I go back to the beginning of this movie, like the opening, 10 minutes or so, where they're introducing Speed, this is, you know, where he was in grade school. This is what he grew up to be. This is his friend Trixie. This is how she met him. This is what's going on with, his brother. This is what's going on with this. Like, it just lays out every piece of this movie, like intertwined in, you know, just this opening racing scene. Yeah. Yes. Like, this action-packed opening race.
Yeah. Like, it's we've said it 1,000 times, but him literally racing his brother, like him like catching up to the shadow of his, you know, fallen, you know, older brother that he looks up to.
Racing the track's ghost data, which was very, familiar from just video games. Just like, oh yeah, ghost data. And they're doing that in this world of racing. Like, they literally just put the best ever racer on the track to be there for people to see.
But it's also, it is perhaps the best example of how this movie uses cinematic language as part of the storytelling in a way that most all audiences' films don't bother to do. With like the way that they're not just simply cutting from scene to scene. They have, you know, the talking head, the racer announcers using their heads as a wipe to transition from screen, you know, just stuff like that, that is so full of artistry and so full of unique cinematic language, but is all purposeful, is all to the point of conveying the story. We don't just go back to a flashback and reveal his whole backstory, info dump style, and then return to the present. We do it periodically as he rounds each turn in the race in the present day. We reveal a new turn in his history. Like,
and then his family is watching him. And so, you know, you catch like the family situation.
And even the danger that his family's in, like, which, like, at when I first watched it, I, you know, just thought it was a gag that, like, you know, a bomb was sent to the house, his brother, like, breaks the mop very quickly, gets it out into the street, and then, like, on rewatch, you're like, no, that is setting up, like, all of the world of, like, the big racers versus the small racers. Like, it's a dangerous world out there.
Yes, a dangerous world where they say some swears. Where,
they do.
And there are big family feelings going on, feelings of loss and abandonment and grief, and
it really fucked me up when I realized that like they had that, like, Spritel was born like after Rex died, like their oldest son passed, and then they had Spritel like afterwards to kind of like fill that void, and he never knew Rex at all. The emotional depth of Spritel.
I'd like to give some flowers to Spritel. I have not IMDb'd this young man. I don't know where he is now or what he's doing, but that is a hell of a performance for a young actor. He is really nailing the comedic timing. He is like fulfilling the role of being the comic relief without being in any way like overbearing or annoying about it. He's just a really genuinely funny kid and embodies that character so, so well. Phenomenal casting for Spritel.
Phenomenal casting for the whole family.
Phenomenal casting for the whole family.
Yeah,
oh,
I know.
God.
Like, just, you know.
Susan Sarandon. Every time, like, emotional core of this movie.
Always a joy. John, I was going to say that about John Goodman.
Effortlessly.
Yeah, the both of them. And it's just, it's so aggravating to me because, you know, we've been through it with this movie at the time. This was not a popular or well-reviewed movie. From literally, like, the beginning of us doing podcasts, the second episode of us recording podcasts was talking about Speed Racer. And our first basically blank of the year was, I remember, a lengthy argument with Darren about how, like, we were just kind of like, no, we like Speed Racer more than The Dark Knight.
And
he couldn't believe it. And then it was like, you know, that conversation kept happening. It's like, no, this was actually the best movie. But just like little by little, like, I think people caught up with us. But I remember at the time people just being like, oh my, this movie, I can't stand watching it. It's just basically like, it's all computer effects. It's just all like, you know, there's nothing real in this movie. But then you look at a lot of other movies these days that are nothing but like computer effects, like we talked about Marvel. And it's just so bland. Everything in this movie, like every scene is like exciting and colorful to look at. Even and, like, you know, the racer's house is like all like purple and pink, and, you know, Royalton is all shiny and purple. And even when there isn't something in motion, it's still just kind of like popping off the screen into your eyes. And it's utilizing computer effects in an artistic way that
it's purposeful.
Not it's not just like, oh, we're being as shiny and flashy as possible. It's like, no, like there's so many sequences in the movie that stand out like that. Like the beginning of the road race.
Oh, where, yeah. The Casa Cristo. Like,
the Casa Cristo, where they're cutting to like the evil racing teams getting paid off. And it's just like, you know, the like the army guys are like looking over their thing of money, and it like it brings the racers up into view as they're like looming over the racetrack. Mm-hmm. Like, yes, this there's a bunch of Vikings and they're just sitting there eating meat, and they give them furs to pay them off. They give them pelts. It's absurd, but it is so much fucking fun as they're like launching Morningstar flails. Like that fight scene, like that fight scene in Cars is so well choreographed.
And one of the biggest laughs I have every time at this point is that Viking fight, because it's it's doing something that you don't need to do, which is doing the jump jet just to punch the guy in the face. Like Rex just like pops up when he's going. He could just let that Viking go right overhead, and he goes, and then they give him a smile at the end and let him go. Like, you don't need to do that.
There's a lot of so many things I could say about, like, so like the legibility of the races and those fight scenes, like going to the trouble of, again, not just doing a simple cut back and forth between when they're talking over their radios, but there's one segment in the rally race where Speed is talking to Trixie, and the camera zooms. Yep, yep. It doesn't just cut; it zooms. It zooms very quickly in between their faces. It doesn't linger. It does it really fast, but it gives you a far better sense of where these characters are in physical space in relation to each other, and thus helps you track this thing that is constantly in motion. So much better than if they just used cuts. Like, they didn't have to do that, but it makes all the action so much more legible.
Just off of that, I feel like I'm sure we've talked about before, but it's just such a direct contrast to, like, you know, like what were the Michael Bay Transformers movies, right? Where it was like everything was mucky and you didn't know where things were. Yeah. And like there wasn't enough separation between things, and you're just confused all of it. Like, you're like, well, there's a sense of action because they keep cutting a lot, but like,
is like these balls of like metal trash roll around, and you can't really tell one from another because they don't have any kind of design that makes them stand out.
Right. I love that description. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
The only complaint I could level against the CG effects in this day and age is that I feel like they are certain shots, not all the shots, but a lot of the shots can feel a bit weightless, and I feel like they would have benefited from a modern, like, just one more shader pass in terms of the lighting and shadow to make things feel like they have a little more weight, because sometimes everything can look like it's all sort of the same level of gamma.
I know what you mean.
What rescues it, I think, is that visual is it's the art direction. It's that everything is so hyper colorful, and that is, when I said the word celebrate, it is it speaks to that notion that it feels like there's an obligation in making an all ages film that in order to appeal to the adults, you have to make fun of the thing. You have to subvert the unreality of it. Like, at some point, someone's got to be like, well, that's not very realistic. Why are we doing this? I don't know. It's a cartoon. And like, so that the adults can chuckle like, oh, ha, 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 it's unrealistic. We all loved this as we were kids, but we can all laugh at how unrealistic. And this movie never does that. At no point. Like, it respects what is cool about a race car movie. Race cars are fun. They're fast. They're bright. They're colorful. That is fun. That is cool. Mm-hmm. It respects what children like, and never condescends and says, no, you're silly for liking this, or this is unrealistic, so let's subvert it and make fun of it. It never does that. And I have a feeling that's a big reason why at the time critics initially didn't like it, because they're like, well, yes, we all remember this from when we were kids, obviously, but like, come on, let's not take this too seriously. But no, it's better if you take it seriously. It's better if you are respectful to the material. lean into what makes it good and enjoyable, because those things are enjoyable to all audiences. It's fun to watch crazy kinetic, hyperkinetic races. The visual design is incredibly fun. If you just let yourself enjoy it and have fun, that is the better decision, is to lean into the things that are fun.
No, when you undercut it, and I think like now audiences are happier for earnest storytelling to a degree. And I think that's, I don't know, like there's less ironic things, but also you're right. Like that's, you know, every Marvel movie does this, whatever. But like when you do that, what like there's so many reasons that it sucks. Like one, you kind of have to start over again in terms of like getting back to the reality of the movie because you're sucked out of it.
Yeah.
And also like I've always, whenever that happens, I'm always like, well, you're the guys making it. If you think it's stupid, then don't make it.
Yes, exactly. Like, yeah. It's insulting. If you can't be bothered to love this, why should I?
Right. Yeah. And nobody is more, you know, wears their heart on their sleeve going 1,000 miles an hour than Wachowski.
I just want to say I really like the shot where they're, you know, they have the scene where the gangsters have Togo Khan, which turns out to be in the back of a truck.
The Batman 66 scene is so good.
But then also just the shot with Racer X like in front of the truck and the truck like weaving around across the road behind him looks like so cool and so weighty. That's awesome. I mean, there's so many shots in this movie that are just like incredible to look at.
Every scene has them. They fly by enough that like when you see it, it's one of those, and I'm sure most of the movies on this list are the same thing, where it's like you get to a new scene and you're like, ooh, this is going to happen. Mm-hmm. You know, like you get excited for the thing in the new scene.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
This is like the fastest, like over 2 hour movie that there is. I think it blows by.
There's a very unique sort of like structural plotting in the middle of the movie where Roger Allam is, I haven't even talked about Roger Allam yet, where he's describing to Speed, you know, like when Speed turns him down and he says, here's how this is going to go down. And then you see those events first before returning to the present, but then you jump to after those events have, like, temporally it could be confusing for a young viewer, but it's not. That, you know, they make it make sense.
Emotionally makes sense.
Gotta rhapsodize about Roger Allam. It is a crime against humanity that he has not been utilized as a film villain in more movies. He is perhaps best known for originating the role of the villain Javert in Broadway's Les Miserables. That is who he is to me. And I've heard him do some voiceover work now and then, but like he is incredible in it. Just what a perfect villain.
He reminds me. Did you ever see Darkman? I'm guessing you guys have seen Darkman. He reminds me a lot of the main, like one of the big bads in that, but yeah, just like
isn't it Jeffrey Combs in Darkman?
No. Okay. Well, it's Liam Neeson, but
I as the antagonist in Darkman, though. I gotta look. Jeffrey Combs was someone in Darkman.
If so, I don't know, but I don't know. From the moment just showing up in a helicopter to using German to describe pancakes. It's just across the board. And as throwing as Skinner was the first time, now I look forward to, you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Also a Michael Giacchino score.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Another one.
He's back.
Yeah, that's
Yeah, but I'm glad that, you know, over the course of the years that followed, like, especially I feel like in the last 5 to 8 years, like, people have caught on that Speed Racer fucking rules. Is one of, if not the best movie of this century so far. Like, it's people have really, and really, you know, even afterwards, it's because nobody mm-hmm. went to see it in the theaters. Not many people went to see it. And I remember like that's periodically over the course of the next like year and a half, like right after the movie, I would, you know, people would just incidentally in conversation, they'd be like, oh, I saw that Speed Racer movie like over the weekend, and there would be a pause. They'd be like, it fucking ruled. Like once people saw it, they were like, oh, that movie was really, really good. Like I never had mm-hmm. anybody who saw it and was like, you know, whatever, it was stupid. Like, no, people, if they actually mm-hmm. watched the movie, they were pretty blown away by it.
I think the only retractors I've had are like people that have a hard time going into that earnestness, like kind of yeah. like what we said, like that. Mm-hmm. But for yeah, and I think at this point, like obviously the sell is the visuals. If you want to get somebody in, you're like, no, this is going to look great. But like, there's so much more to it than that. I think that's mm-hmm. kind of the fun is. People treat it like I haven't seen Tenet, but like the way people talk about Tenet, where it's just sort of like, well, it's this beautiful spectacle. Yeah, the script is whatever, but like the script is not whatever for Speed Racer. Yeah, like the family unit works. Yeah,
it is. It occurred to me at one point, and maybe this is me always trying to sort of find the narrative through line with filmmakers, particular auvoirs, but I think you can definitely read this film as a lot of like, it's reductive to say it's the Matrix for kids, but there's a lot of the same themes of self-actualization and like realizing that you don't need to be bound by the limits of what the world or society tells you, that you know, following your own path, trusting yourself, trusting in a sense of flow and self and self-actualization. I guess I already said it, but all those themes are there in this movie.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and it's just every viewing more and more, just the strongest anti-capitalist movie.
Yeah, you know,
like it is. I mean that big speech and like the whole crux of the movie of just sort of like, well, oh, you watched that race. Well, here's what was really going on. Yeah. And like, well, actually that doesn't matter. All that. Yeah.
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 Great movie. Yep. I'm very glad I rewatched it last, even though it did not make my top 10. I'm mm-hmm. it was just such a joy to rewatch. And mm-hmm. I wish I could have convinced my kids to finally, I've been trying to convince them to watch it with me. Mm-hmm. They decided to watch The Devil Wears Prada 2 instead, and they did not have nearly as good a time as that. They all regretted their choice. They were like, yeah, it was not that great, Dad. We should have watched your movie.
That just leaves us with Dave's number one.
Yeah, you know what? It almost feels silly to go back and talk about this little movie after rhapsodizing about what is obviously the greatest movie of the 21st century. But
another tight family unit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In a race against time. No, the Royal Tenenbaums has long, for years, off and on, been my favorite movie of all time. With Back to the Future sometimes edging it out depending on my mood. It is my favorite Wes Anderson movie. Fantastic Mr. Fox did very narrowly escape getting in my top 10. Mm-hmm. But to me, this is, you know, I feel like we've put it this way before. Sometimes your favorite Wes Anderson movie is the first one that you see. This was my first, and so maybe that's why it's my favorite. But to me, it is the spirit that it captures is so emblematic of the feeling that Wes Anderson's films try to recapture, that very sort of like late 70s Technicolor vibe. This is the most emblematic of it. Simon and Garfunkel, there's all of his movies do this very well, but to me, there's none no other of his movies established this real definitive sense of place and personality when you've got these New York brownstones and the wardrobe mm-hmm. that they're all wearing and Simon and Garfunkel on the soundtrack. Like, all those mm-hmm. things just really vibe to transport you to this particular sense of place. Mm-hmm. I love all the performances in this movie. It is, to me, the model of, like, understated modern acting that I want to see in a highly stylized, in a still highly stylized movie, mm-hmm. but not nearly as stylized as his movies would become. It still feels a bit more grounded in reality compared to his later work. Yeah, for me, it's just the real sweet spot. It is why I love his films. Even when his excess makes me roll my eyes sometimes. But this is the one for me. This is the one that captured my heart.
Yeah, and I go back and forth. Like Life Aquatic is really high up there for me. Fantastic Mr. Fox is really high up there for me. And, you know, like, whatever, it could be day to day. But, like, Tenenbaums has a very specific feel, like you said. Like, and I'm usually pretty good with his excess. There's only, like, a couple that, like, drive me crazy. It's not usually because of that. But, like you said, like, I don't know. Like, this one, I don't know if... I feel like Tenenbaums and Life Aquatic and Fantastic Mr. Fox, like, the top ones have moments that, like, the modern ones, as much as I like Budapest and some of the newer ones, just nothing beats Gwyneth Paltrow coming off the bus. Yeah. And not only, yeah. like, to the music, that shot, and, like, going from how emotional that is, you know, Wilson watching her to them talking to each other and having no emotion,
yeah.
you know,
yeah,
of just sort of like, hey, how's it going?
Well, I've said, I feel like I've said this on the podcast before talking about this film, but the reason that I first saw it is because my acting teacher at the time in college had just seen it, and he was an old hippie. He was like he was the perfect guy to credibly declare this to us, that this was the closest thing he had ever seen to Chekhov in modern cinema. Sure. And the thing about Chekhov is that was revolutionary about the my teenager is currently studying Chekhov in the Moscow Art Theater at her theater classes that she's taking over the summer. And we study it because it was this huge shift in acting, whereas for centuries before, characters said exactly what was on their minds, whereas all of a sudden it occurred to Chekhov and Stanislavski, what if they didn't? This book presupposes what if they didn't? And instead, you know, doing everything they can to stoically conceal their true feelings while those true feelings very clearly and heartbreakingly bubble under the surface. So for me, this was also at a time when I was learning about that particular acting style. This made it very clear that it still is vital and works in modern acting today. It's why we do this. It is still, you know, kind of the exemplar of modern acting for me in many ways, because it is the emblematic of that style. I'm talking in circles now, forgive me.
Oh, no. I have not thought about it in, like, it's interesting because I think of when I've watched it before, like, discussing it like that, I think of more how direct, like, I picture it as, like, oh, they're directed to, like, hold this stuff back versus, like, right, there's a lot of choices, a lot of subtle choices I'm just, like, not thinking about going on, and just, like, where it is leading you and where it wants you to, like, think. Yeah.
And I think another thing that I love about this movie as opposed to some of his later works is that I think it's the members, it's the Gene Hackman and Danny Glover at Angelica Houston sort of being representative of the overall sense that the movie has, and that Chekhov did too, that this is something grand in a state of decline. You know, that we are wishfully looking back at when things were great, but were they ever really great? That is a theme in all of Chekhov's works, and it is something that actors that famous, that well known, can bring to that sort of thing. And I think maybe that's what's missing in his later works, that focuses on actors that are younger, and while they are, you know, inarguably famous actors who have had long and storied careers, they're not at that point yet.
That's
something that really, I think, sells that feeling for me, is that Gene Hackman feels like he belongs here.
And I mean, what a magical moment to get Gene Hackman in the first place. Like, at that point in his career, like, I think he only did maybe like the only movie I can think after it was Heist. I'm sure he had other stuff.
But not much.
And infamously, like, a hard person to work with.
Yeah.
Like, so like a studio saying, okay, we'll work with Gene Hackman. I was as much as, like, everybody is so subdued, like, Gene Hackman gets to be the person who's kind of speaking his mind because he's a scamp, you know?
Yeah.
And he has that power of being, you know, the guy from French Connection. But you've seen him do things.
Yeah.
You've also seen him be goofy Lex Luthor, but yeah.
Yeah. No, but there is an authoritative. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I forgot about goofy Lex Luthor. There is an authority to that, to the sense of earned wisdom that he brings to the role by just sort of knowing that he's Gene Hackman. So it's great casting. It's great casting across the board. It's you know, Ben Stiller, known for comedy up at that point, getting to be vulnerable. Mm-hmm. It's so much. Yeah. No, I love it.
Yeah.
And
Yeah.
All right.
And still there is my number three.
I still haven't seen it.
It's good.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Yeah. Sorry. Someday.
Yeah, if you want, like, a warm, like, fall movie.
Yeah.
Like, it's definitely good for that.
Yeah.
At some point.
Very much a fall movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wanna.
Yeah.
Well, fall's coming up pretty soon. All right, but that's going to do it. All right. Hey, let's run down some of the near misses here.
Yes.
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah, like, I think there's a lot that merits discussion. All right. So what were your biggest wish you could have included?
I had, and this is because I haven't rewatched it, but I put Swiss Army Man.
Okay.
I'm not sure if either of you have seen it, but What the Daniels Made Before Everything Everywhere All at Once, which is the Harry Potter farting corpse movie. Yes. That is
still haven't seen it. Always meant to. Yeah. Always meant to get around to it.
I'm really curious, like, if you get, you know, it's Paul Dano and you know, Daniel Radcliffe, just like, but it's basically Paul Dano, you know, like, as a oneer sort of thing. It's very, it just, much like a lot of the movies on here, like, once it, like, gets going, it has a lot of, like, emotional surprises for, like, how big and pulpy, like he's using Daniel Radcliffe as, like, a machine gun at times. Like, it is just as, like, visually goofy as Everything Everywhere, but, like, I personally prefer it just for it being this really, like, intimate kind of, like, emotional, like, story. A lot of stuff I haven't revisited. There was this Japanese movie called Fish Story that's just fucking cool. That's it's this punk band that recorded this song that nobody heard, but, like, it inspires four different decades of, like, people hear this song, and, like, it kind of, like, it culminates in very, like, interesting, just sort of, like, has that, like, that melancholy artist did a thing, and then they don't think that, like, anything came of it, and you're like, no, it was still important you did that thing, sort of thing. And it
sounds like a vibe. That sounds like a good vibe.
Cool. Yeah. It's really cool. Yeah.
Anyone have anything that you thought for sure, or anyone have anything that you recently decided, nope, I always thought I loved this, but actually maybe I don't anymore. You know, I think, like, rewatching Anchorman fairly recently, I was like, I remember I loved this movie for so long, but it just doesn't hold up.
Nothing that I have like revisited.
We danced around it, but the obvious, like the Tarantino-ness of, okay. So like, yeah. You know, Kill Bill, has always been super high on my list, and like
Kill Bill is exactly the one I wanted to talk about. So let's talk about it.
Yeah. And there may be a time in the future that I can kind of separate art from artist, sort of thing. But, you know, I was waiting so long to finally see The Whole Bloody Affair. Yeah. And by the time it came out, he's such a gross person.
Yeah.
I just can't do it.
It is hard. So I did start rewatch. I got about an hour, 90 minutes or so into The Whole Bloody Affair within the past week. And it does get to the point where it won me over again. It took a while, though. Like, you do get to the point where you're like, oh, I remember why I loved this movie. I remember why this is such a celebration of all of the things that he loves. Again, it, like, honors the things that are inherently ridiculous in schlocky exploitive cinema that Tarantino loves. He celebrates them. He joyfully celebrates them and makes you enjoy them, too. It's hard not to get won over by them because the movie does get to a point where it is really winning in earnest. But to get there, you have to suffer through a lot of, like, boy, this guy just maybe loves to glorify violence against women, particularly sexual violence. Like, this just gives me a big ick for a long. There's a lot of ick to get through to find the good stuff again, which was a real bummer.
Because
Kill Bill has always been, mentally I held it up as sort of, I think that's my favorite Tarantino movie, at least my favorite Tarantino movie of the past. But it's too bad.
Yeah.
That was the main one for me. Oh, that and Darren Aronofsky just keeps being a bigger and bigger piece of shit. And
oh, I didn't know that one.
Mother, I mean, which I know is a highly divisive film, but it is the
never
one
saw.
It's a very divisive film. For me, it's the one that stands out in my mind and like makes me it's so off the wall, wacky and crazy in a lot of ways, but also in a lot of ways the most memorable. It's the movie of his that I, keep thinking about even years later, but he's a piece of shit. So it's apparently a plagiarist.
All the Satoshi Kon stuff been. Yeah.
So that's a bummer.
Yeah. That one's a bummer. Like on the reverse, like I don't know. Like there's definitely part of me that wanted to get out in there. And it should still be talked about.
I've got it at 13 right now, so real close. Mm-hmm.
I don't number them past 10, but
I didn't end this time, but
so another animated movie I was struggling with in the Spirit Away slot was Coraline.
I had that in my short list.
Coraline, and of course WALL-E, which I mentioned. The Host was pretty high on my list.
I wasn't sure if you would mention.
That almost made it, and then I was like, I feel like I need to talk about a martial arts movie.
I figured that might be the Godzilla slot, but I wasn't sure.
Everything Everywhere All at Once was kind of down there a little bit. It was really kind of my really what's simmering outside the top 10 is me trying to figure out like a horror movie to put on there, really. Because The Mist is also there. 28 Days Later is there.
Mandy was close for me.
Yeah. What wasn't close to making my list, but I was surprised when I saw it and I was like, I should write this down for consideration, was The Descent, which is a movie I think about a lot.
That's a good movie.
Is good. It's a movie that I reference more than one would think that one should.
Green Room similarly has been one that like it's a nasty piece of work and it's a hard one to be like I'm gonna throw this on just casually, it's just such a perfect sense of rhythm and just like a movie I reference all the time at this point.
Unbreakable being probably my favorite M. Night movie.
Same. Oh
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Shoot, Unbreakable.
Yeah. That was close. Mm-hmm. I was like, that should probably should, but it doesn't mm-hmm. quite just make it.
Anything that you thought was too new that you felt like you didn't have a perspective on yet to be able to.
Yeah, I didn't really think about stuff from like the past couple of years, like Sinners, or like mm-hmm. a couple other things that I had written down somewhere.
Because I was pretty Sinners. I've got Barbie. I've got Nosferatu.
I don't remember what my
RRR was very close for me. RRR.
Yeah.
That's especially if you get to see that in the theater. Like there is, it's a dance in the aisle. Like people will get up and celebrate kind of movie. Like,
oh man.
I guess The Martian. I haven't read the book, but I am actually reading Project Hail Mary right now, and I'm gonna watch the movie.
Version's great.
It's kind of interesting to mention.
Yeah, the only other one I had on mind that we haven't mentioned is it's like it felt a little too hipstery for me, but like the Nathan Fielder finale is an incredible movie. That I still had as like my top movie of whatever year that came out. I don't think it was like there were a lot of stuff that was popping at that point, but it does kind of represent a lot of like where like that specific sense of humor kind of like, you know, not only the Nathan Fielder stuff, but Tim Robinson stuff too. Yeah. I feel like, you know, so it did kind of kickstart a lot of like that style of comedy documentary, docu-series kind of thing. Mm-hmm. John Wilson, all of that.
A lot of movies that like, I was really struggling to find, like, what are the like serious dramas that stayed with me? And so many are like, I remember really loving them at the time and thinking, oh yeah, this is a big important movie. Like, I remember loving Clooney's Good Night and Good Luck.
Yep. That's on there.
Okay. Brokeback Mountain. I still think about, it was a beautiful mm-hmm. film and Judas and the Black Messiah is a recent drama.
Oh, I never got to see. Yeah.
Oh, the one. Yeah. Wonderful, wonderful mm-hmm. film. None of those could quite hit that, like, I love this movie, you know, that earned mm-hmm. a place in the top 10 as those others. I even got a few Disney movies. I've got like Encanto, which is, you know, a beautiful film, and Lin-Manuel Miranda's second best musical. You know, perhaps the best modern Disney musical, mm-hmm. Snowpiercer. God,
yeah,
we're dancing around Bong in the second tier here. I feel like Parasite would have been mine if I was I was grabbing one. I think.
I jotted down the first John Wick before that became like a whole franchise of mm-hmm. things and was just like a simple action movie.
Yep, that's still the best one.
I did write down Alita Battle Angel, which is like a lesser anime adaptation than Speed Racer, you know, in every way, but still like, you know, I really enjoyed it. Toy Story 3, you know,
I wrote down Toy Story 3.
Yeah. District 9, which I'm, mm-hmm. I'm just like, I can't remember that movie. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just, he has had a weird journey at this point, unfortunately. Yes,
absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Jojo Rabbit was one I wrote that I also recently rewatched, and I'm like, oh man, this is a great time. This is a movie. This is mm-hmm. totally a movie you can just put on and enjoy. An old one that I used to love that I can no longer vouch for loving is mm-hmm. Sofia Coppola's Lost in Translation. You know, that I remember as a young pretentious college, you know, actor, mm-hmm. I remember absolutely loving that film. And I bet it's still a pretty good film.
Ugh, I couldn't stand that fucking movie.
Vincey?
Yeah.
It's a travelogue.
And another, you know, need to revisit a few of these as a thing. Cause like Hero, I would love to have like the post Crouching Tiger, you know, like the wushu, you know, wire foo mm-hmm. era, but need to go back to A Serious Man is in there. Yeah. we said.
Yeah, I guess so many Coen Brothers movies that could easily be on this list.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was Buster, like the sweet spot.
The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. You know, there's so many like COVID-era movies that came out, you know, wound up direct to streaming and probably just evaporated into the public consciousness because they didn't necessarily get a big theatrical release.
Go ahead.
The sweet spot Mission Impossibles, like 3 and Ghost Protocol.
That didn't even cross my mind. That's kind of
top. I remember fucking loving Ghost Protocol.
Yeah.
At the time. Yeah.
Kiss Kiss Bang Bang and The Nice Guys, like the kind of like those really good Shane Black, just like newer buddy movies that, you know, like we got one with Iron Man 3, but like there's some goodies in there. Long Bach, Winnebago Man, you know, like
Protector was on there. Yeah. Long Bach.
Yeah, exactly.
Where's My Elephant?
Yeah. Yep. A classic. Where's My Elephant?
Classic. Where's My Elephant? Another thing I reference.
I
think much anything else people mentioned or was touched on at some point in this, this event. So.
Yeah. And I feel like we all had stuff that, like, you know, both of you have stuff that I would have loved to have had in mine, you know, Saw the TV Glow. Especially feels weird to not have in there.
Yeah, no, same. It occurred to me so much of, you know, for 14 of the past 26 years, I've been a parent. And so that has really skewed my film intake toward more all ages films. So there's definitely a lot more. I just have more exposure to those over more than half of this timeline. So I almost felt like, am I unfairly weighting those in favor of other films that I just haven't seen? And so I trusted that, you know, your list, Weiss especially, would probably have some of my more esoteric favorites that I wish I could have honored. I think we had about as much overlap as I would have expected. So
Like, I always, you know, like, there's stuff that I'm like, this is too basic, or, you know, want to include more stuff. But that's why we talk about the other stuff.
Yeah. Good lists, guys.
Good lists.
Ah, we did it. Let's watch all the things.
Let's watch all the things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's going to do it for this episode.
We'll be back
in a month or so with a normal-ish episode. I think it might be a little longer than a month. Given that it's the second and first week of September is the last week before school starts this coming year.
I see.
Which is a real mess of a situation.
Wait, say that again, because
the first week of September is the last week before school starts. Because Labor Day, because school generally starts on the 8th because September 1st is a Tuesday. So Labor Day is as late as it could possibly for New York. New York schools generally begin the day or a day or two after Labor Day.
Yes.
So it is a very late start for New York schools, which affects both Dave's life and my life.
Yes.
Out
here in Rochester, half the school districts are starting before Labor Day and the other half
I wish they'd all fucking do that.
Yeah. I am teaching a week-long acting class for teens. From the 31st to September 4th. And we have very low enrollment because no one realized that half the schools will be open by then. So it's a bummer.
Not normal. It's because it's so late. All right. Well, anyways, that's no need to talk about state school drama, but it does affect when you're going to hear our next podcast.
Yeah.
So thank y'all for listening. We'll catch you next time.
All right. Good night.
Good night.